You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Are we in the midst of an impeachment, a coup d'etat, or something else? Just what are we to make of all these investigations? Emmy-nominated commentator on both legal and political matters, Dean Johnson joins me in the studio tonight. And tonight there's so much to discuss. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local area, that's for most folks. If you're not in San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, and we'll pick up the freight. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic of law and politics, about the various investigations, the possibility of an impeachment. We may be talking nuts and bolts. We're not going to limit you to where we are in the conversation. Brief comments are okay as well. Nobody's going to take on 20 minutes and earn their 15 minutes tonight. But if you have something brief to say and a comment, you're welcome to. If you have questions about just what all this means and how it works, feel free to call us toll-free. Again, that number is 866-798-8255. And Dean Johnson, with that, let me once again welcome you back to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here again. And let me just reiterate what you said. What we're going to talk about tonight, this impeachment process, has so many moving parts. There's so many tentacles that reach into Syria, the Ukraine, Russia, the halls of the Senate and the halls of Congress, that I would encourage your listeners to call in with any questions they have on any of those areas, and we'll just let this roll.
So where are we now? Just where are we? I mean, are we really on the road that's going to lead to impeachment, or is this, as the president says, a coup d'etat?
Well, like you said in the opening, you know, this could be an impeachment, this could be a coup d'etat, or it could be something else. And my answer would be, yes, this is something else. And the something else that we're faced with at this point is, remarkably enough, something that those brilliant men over 200 years ago, are the founders of our republic, the authors of our Constitution, envisioned. This was exactly the sort of thing that they were talking about when they tried to decide whether or not to put an impeachment clause in the Constitution. And what they were concerned with, and remember, they were representatives of 13 tiny colonies nestled on the east coast of North America, and they were concerned with what they called foreign entanglements. And their fear was that the empires of Europe would use their power, their influence, their military, their budget, to overwhelm the presidency of the United States and exert undue influence. What we're seeing here is something similar to that, but it's sort of the flip side of that. The United States is now so powerful that our president can, and it appears has, exert influence over the countries of Europe and perhaps other parts of the world, and possibly to the point where his actions have risen to the level of an impeachable offense.
Now, we haven't seen the end game. We don't know where this is all going. And from our perspective here at this time, we're still watching this unfold and don't really know where the evidence is going to lead. But isn't the allegation that he ultimately used the power of the country to get a foreign power to do exactly what you just said?
Yeah, the leading piece of evidence is a recording of a telephone conversation that took place on July 25th between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, who is also, like Trump, a former TV star. And they had a very friendly conversation up to the point that Zelensky said, you know, Mr. President, I really could use some military aid to help me with the fact that there are Russians and Russian agents occupying part of my country, at which point the president talked about a conspiracy theory that has been long since debunked, and then went into a discussion of his what was then seen as his leading political opponent, Joe Biden, and suggested that if you really want all of that aid, which, by the way, the president had held back, had decided to withhold before this conversation took place, if you really want all of that aid, President Zelensky, let me suggest that you might want to reopen an investigation into the role of Joe Biden and his son Hunter in the Ukraine. And you might want to be looking at the possibility that their activities were corrupt. A few days later, President Zelensky appointed a prosecutor named Konstantin Kulyuk to reopen the Biden dossier and explore that investigation further. Kulyuk himself has been indicted three times for corruption. He's been known to use criminal charges to quiet or to threaten political opponents, but he's the guy who was looking into Biden, and people are saying that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. It certainly looks like there's a causal connection running from Donald Trump's request to President Zelensky to the prosecutors in the Ukraine. And it looks like Donald Trump was trying to use the wealth and power of the United States, use funds that were allocated by the Congress for the security of the Ukraine as leverage to gain a political advantage over the person he perceives as a primary opponent. Now, where this goes, we don't know. As you say, we have seen the tip of the iceberg. I know I sound like I'm giving a lot of detail here, but believe me, this is just the beginning. It reaches to the president's personal attorney, or the person who was his personal attorney at that time, Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani then reaches to four Soviet-born Florida businessmen who funneled money through various straw corporations to encourage the removal of the anti-corruption U.S. ambassador, who was then removed, who then testified to Congress about the impropriety of her removal and corruption in the Ukraine. And it goes on and on and on.
So let's part with the substance for right now.
Sure.
And let's take a bigger look from 5,000 feet on just what the mechanics are of what's going on right now. Does impeachment mean that the president's thrown out of office? I mean, my understanding is it's really a charge rather than a conviction.
Right. Now, the first thing we always tell people when we talk about the impeachment process is that impeachment process is something of a misnomer. Impeachment is not the same as conviction. The best way to think about this whole process is that it's very much like a criminal prosecution. And the Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate play various roles in this prosecution. It's the Congress's function to investigate, to gather evidence, and then to decide whether or not to issue what we call articles of impeachment. And at that point, the president is impeached. The articles of impeachment aren't a conviction. They're simply, they serve like a criminal complaint. They're like the charges that a district attorney would file if he or she were filing a criminal case. Those articles, once issued, are then taken to the Senate by members of the designated members of the House of Representatives, physically bring the articles of impeachment, the document, to the Senate floor. And at that point, they're referred to, these representatives are referred to as the managers of the impeachment. They're the prosecutors, and they will present the prosecution side of the case, the evidence in support of removal of the president from office. The president is within a designated period of time summoned to the Senate To answer the charges, he has to file a document called an answer. He has a right to counsel. And then the Senate essentially decides on its own what rules they're going to follow in terms of taking testimony, hearing evidence, and once they're satisfied with the evidence, they decide. They decide like a jury of 100 people. They're literally sworn in as a jury. And if they if two-thirds of them decide that the evidence is sufficient to constitute, in the constitutional phrase, a high crime or misdemeanor, the president is convicted. That's the term they use. And he is removed from office, which is the only punishment that the Senate can impose. If there is not a two-thirds vote to remove, then he is acquitted, just like a defendant in a criminal case is acquitted, and he goes back to work.
So in a lot of ways, the House is like a grand jury, and the Senate is like a jury.
Exactly. The House functions as both grand jury and then as prosecutors. The Senate functions as a jury, and there's even a presiding judge. When the president is the accused party, the presiding judge is the Chief Justice of the United States. And as soon as the articles are brought to the Senate floor and read to the Senate, the presiding officer of the Senate sends a message to the Chief Justice of the United States and says, Your Honor, we're going to have a trial in the next few days. Would you please come over and preside? The Chief Justice is allowed to rule on issues of evidence, on motions, on writs. It's very much like your typical criminal trial, except the defendant is the president and there's a jury of 100 instead of 12.
You know, I'm going to get a little broader. The president stated he's entitled to confront witnesses. There's also widespread concerns about the whistleblower's complaint being based on hearsay. And you've heard the White House counsel referring to the idea that they don't need to turn anything over unless we have a complete House vote in favor of impeachment, or at least of an impeachment inquiry, which I don't think is the case. But starting at square one, where do they get their procedures from? And that's what the White House does, what the House does. Where are all these things set out, if they are set out somewhere?
Well, let's start with the House of Representatives. What's going on now is that the president and the White House are being subpoenaed. Witnesses are being called. Documents are being requested to be brought to the House of Representatives so they can perform, if you will, their grand jury function. They can gather the evidence, decide if the evidence warrants articles of impeachment, and then if they decide that, they can issue the articles of impeachment. Right now, the president is really working for time. And the objection that's been raised over the last few days is, oh, well, you haven't formally decided that you're going to do an impeachment inquiry in the House. You have to vote on that before you can even start issuing subpoenas. And it's a fairly colorable delaying tactic. There is nothing in the Constitution, there is no statute, there is no House rule that says that there has to be a formal vote. The House and the Senate have extremely broad powers to investigate virtually anything that relates to public policy, and the three committees that are involved, Judiciary, Oversight, and Intelligence, are working towards gathering the evidence, and they can continue to do that as long as they want. The reason, in addition to buying time, the White House is also hoping to paint the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives into a corner and to force various representatives who are in marginal districts that may go for Trump or may go for a Democrat and are, if you will, swing districts, to commit themselves one way or the other in the hope that there would not be a formal resolution of impeachment, and then the whole process could be deemed illegitimate.
Or alternatively, perhaps, that they commit themselves and put their seats in jeopardy.
Precisely. You have to remember that these are first and foremost politicians, and everything that's done by any party in this proceeding is strategic, and they are always looking at the polls, and they're always looking at their own political future, because it doesn't matter whether you're, as a politician, whether your purposes are benign or evil. You can't do what you want to do and achieve what you want to achieve with political power unless you first play the game and retain political power.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We're looking at the nuts and bolts of the congressional investigations underway that might lead to impeachment. If you have questions for my guest tonight is Dean Johnson, Emmy-nominated commentator, both legal and political. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call about any question on the topic. Tonight, we're talking about law and politics and these investigations that are underway. But you can call about anything on point. You don't have to be exactly where we are in the conversation. And again, if you're outside of San Francisco, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Let me welcome Deborah in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Well, you know, I've been obsessively fascinated by all of the things that have been going on since the Trump presidency. I got through the shock period and the anger and the mourning periods that so many of us experienced in the awareness that, you know, we've got this person who appears to have a severe mental illness in the position of maximum power. But for me, really what the concern is, and I mean, I do understand that people have and bring with them their own agendas. So for me, one of the most concerning aspects of the process is the unveiling of the massive numbers of Republican enablers and people who had previously had reputations that were ones of honor and respect. And maybe it is that we didn't actually know them, but it seems like in contact with Trump or his organization, they have shed any semblance of remote sense of decency and or adherence to what might be the truth. It's pretty obvious that the people that have concerns about that have been leaving the administration in droves. I mean, you know, there's a huge exodus that's obvious. However, you know, the Mitch McConnells, the Lindsey Grahams, the, you know, Sessions, the individuals that have long been participants in governance who are, you know, quoted from ancient or from, you know, archived interviews as, you know, coming up with sort of decency, have sort of dropped the facade of that in connection with Trump. And now, I grant you, I understand that he's the leader of the party. However, I mean, is there no line or decency that these enablers will not participate, or are they so, so very embedded and tainted by their participation in the misdeeds of this miscreant narcissist?
Well, Deborah, before I turn it over to my guest, I think the short answer from my perspective is that these congressional leaders of the president's party are very worried about double-crossing or crossing this president when he maintains a large base that makes up a good 30% of the voting bloc of the country, and how many seats in some of these purple districts that we've been talking about might go up for grabs if they were to cross him. So it's starting to get a bit more tense when you listen to somebody like, I should not be answering the question. I should be passing it on to my guest. But I think we're starting to see some of the veneer get a little worn. How do you see this, Dean?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Deborah and Jeff both. The one thing we learn, especially when we're in media, is that there is a large disconnect between the image that people present and what they really do. I teach a course in what we call game theory, where we talk about the logic of political survival and why people in politics do what they do. And I always tell my students, I say, look, this is a game. Politics is a game with no rules, played by utterly ruthless people who have massive resources, and it's played for unimaginably high stakes. And people play the game to stay in power, and if they don't, they rapidly lose power. And whether their motives are good or bad, if they don't play that political game, they're out of power very quickly. And that's what we're seeing. And my students always reacted with, no, we're a democratic society. These are public-spirited people who could be making money in the private sector, but they've given up that to go into public service. And I say, look, that's the veneer that they want you to see. What's really going on behind the scenes is that everybody is looking to maintain their own individual political power. What we're seeing now is, as you quite accurately put it, is exposure of how the game is really played. And you're seeing one of the most ruthless, open players of this game, and you're hearing recorded conversations. It comes as a shock, but for many of us here who are used to American democratic institutions, it's a cold bath of reality.
One of the things I found interesting that you were talking about earlier is bringing up debunked theories to try to get investigations and ultimately a search to either find dirt or create some if there isn't some there. And it reminds me so much of what we were hearing a few years ago, 6-8 years ago, with the whole birther movement. And it was established time and time again that President Obama was born in Hawaii, which at the time was part of the United States, and although pre-statehood, but it was part of the United States. He was a born United States citizen. It's really shocking how somebody who is an expert in branding could really use something like that and say it often enough that a huge percentage of the voting population will buy into it, right or wrong. But we're really askew from the idea of impeachment and what lines may or may not have been crossed, and more particularly, what we're all looking forward to seeing in terms of airing it out and exactly how this will be decided in a manner that's not only fair to the president and fair to the opponents that think he's really crossed certain lines, but also fair and open enough to hold our republic together and really get to the bottom of it so that everybody can accept the outcome, whatever that outcome might be. Let me turn it to Greg in Palo Alto. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. A couple of comments, I guess, and maybe some questions. One is, the first thing is that there was a second whistleblower, apparently, who surfaced. But that issue has just been, I haven't heard that done in any manner, I mean, looked into in any manner and broadcast, you know, on any outlet that I'm aware of. So I'd just be curious what happened to that, because if that's true, and it seems like that, at least the information that I learned was that second whistleblower was able to confirm what the first whistleblower had said. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I hope that the Democrats don't just rely on this Ukraine issue. I hope that they really do a comprehensive impeachment in the sense that they look into the issues that Mueller raised in his report regarding obstruction of justice, et cetera. And also, they look into financial crimes, Trump's violations of the emolument clause, et cetera, so that they don't pin everything on this Ukraine issue. I think it'd be a serious mistake on the part of the Democrats to do that. And I say one last thing about that. If the Democrats can't lay out a convincing case, a credible and convincing case on a more comprehensive impeachment going forward, then they've got a problem. And I think they could do that. I don't know if they're going to do it, but I hope that they will, because I do think it would be a serious mistake just to pin everything on this Ukraine issue.
Let me turn it over to my guest, but I do have one question. I mean, it looks to me from what Greg was saying, that we're looking at a lot of different little parts, whether it's the violation of the Emoluments Clause, which many of our legal experts tell us doesn't necessarily apply to the president, whether it's the Ukraine issue, whether it's putting his family in offices in the White House, and while none of them are taking salaries, the fact is they're going out and running his corporation at the same time that they hold offices in the White House. We see lots of different stuff, but I think on a more basic level, the question is whether he is using the tools of the government to his own means. But let me turn it over to Dean, because I see there's a lot of individual questions that Greg just asked.
Yeah, you know, one way to think about this, Greg, you raised the Mueller report. One way to think about this whole issue with the Ukraine is as Mueller Report 2, because the Ukraine and Russia obviously are tied together. It's sometimes said that Vladimir Putin is a very religious man, and people think that at night when he says his prayers, he prays that that God will put a mountain range in the Ukraine so he can't be invaded from Western Europe. They are tied together. Trump's interest in Russia and his interest in Ukraine are tied together. In this investigation, all roads are ultimately going to lead back to Russia and to Eastern Europe. But using the Ukraine, you're also correct that using the Ukraine as the sole basis for the impeachment process might create problems, because we have something here that we didn't have in the Mueller report. We have Donald Trump on tape, and we know exactly what he said. So we have physical evidence of actions by Trump himself. The problem with that is the same problem that we had with certain actions in the Mueller report. Does this rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the standard for impeachment? I think it does. Interestingly enough, I was referring to the sort of Bible on impeachment, which is called Impeachment of Citizens Handbook by the Yale professor Charles Black, and he discusses possible scenarios for impeachment, and he says, yeah, you know, one of the most likely scenarios for impeachment, and he was writing in the 70s, one of the most likely scenarios is just that, that a president would decide to use the power of the United States, especially money allocated by Congress for certain purposes, to gain political advantage. That could qualify as a high crime or misdemeanor, but is it the kind of thing that's going to bring around, first of all, Republican Congress people, and secondly, Republican senators, so that there would be an impeachment and a removal from office? I think we're going to need something much stronger and much broader. But as I said before, we're looking at the tip of the iceberg right now. There's a lot of moving parts to this. It goes broad, it goes deep, and there are going to be a lot more reveals before we get to the trial.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We're looking at the nuts and bolts of the congressional investigations underway. Last I counted, there were, what, five underway, six? That might lead to impeachment. If you have questions for my guest, Emmy-nominated legal and political commentator Dean Johnson, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, and for most of us that means if you're outside of San Francisco, let us pick up the freight. You can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question or brief comment on the topic. You don't have to be exactly where we are in our conversation. And again, if you're outside of the local dialing area, toll-free, 866-798-8255. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Mm-hmm. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Let me turn it next to Art in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
The previous caller kind of asked my question, but I would like, if there's any more to be said about that, that I think it's a problem if the Democrats totally rely on just the course that they've started on with their focus on the one issue. I think it's much better to go into all the various potential articles of impeachment that this president may be found guilty on, as opposed to simplifying it down to one situation. I'd like your expert's point of view on that. And also wonder if it would be worthwhile for listeners in the Bay Area to, we probably, just from our news reading, could come up with different parts of the articles of impeachment. I mean, it could be a kind of a parlor game to contribute our ideas. So that's the second question, if you don't have much to say on the first one.
Yeah, I love it, Art. We'll call it Name That Article or some sort of thing, and we can all send in our proposed articles of impeachment and vote for the best article. I like it. As far as relying on the Ukraine scandal as the sole basis for the articles, I doubt that will happen. I think there's a lot more evidence coming forward. I think there are a lot of things that the president and the administration are doing that could be fodder for articles of impeachment. But look at this in a broader context, Art. Remember, the impeachment process is a legal process, but it's also a political process. Regardless of what the articles of impeachment say, how Donald Trump is doing politically is going to figure in the decision to issue articles, and is going to figure prominently in how the trial goes for Donald Trump. The fact that he has precipitously withdrawn troops from Syria, and that's resulted in a horrific blowback that may lead to genocide of a group, an ethnic group that has historically been one of our allies, that's going to be a factor. If the economy goes in the tank, that's going to be a factor. The nepotism is going to be a factor. All of those things are going to be things that people are considering in determining how to vote. But you do have to have that core of a high crime or misdemeanor, and you do have to have evidence to support it. So the articles will lay out those incidents that the Congress believes constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors primarily will come from Ukraine, but all of that stuff is going to play a role. And just as an aside, I'd like to congratulate us on our track record. It was about a year ago we were on the air when we talked about the upcoming stories of 2019, and we said one of the big stories is going to be Donald Trump's precipitous withdrawal from Syria and the blowback that ensues. So our track record is very good.
We have a couple callers I want to turn to, but before I do, just as an aside, I do want to point out my guest, Dean Johnson, one of the other hats that he wears is the founder of Pundit Networks. And for those that haven't been there, it's a website, I'll let you give it in a moment, where you can go in and predict various things because they ask you to point out. And what their theory is the lot of us is way smarter than any one of us. And it's really designed to ask individual opinions, predictions, How accurate is there? Are their predictions?
Well, we when we originally tested Pundit Network with 7,000 college students, we were able to generate predictions with 84.6% accuracy. And the predictions included areas of sports, entertainment, trends in technology, and politics. And we encourage people to join us because the theory behind it is what's known as the wisdom of the crowds. And that theory says that as a matter of mathematical certainty, if a group of people like your audience who are well informed about a subject, weigh in on a subject, their predictions can be better and more accurate and more reliable than any individual expert like me. And this grew out of my work in television and radio as a pundit and my annoyance with the fact that some of my colleagues were truly no more accurate than random chance. And I felt that people who listen to media deserve something better, especially when they as listeners can produce something better themselves. So I would encourage people to sign up for punditnetwork.com. It's simply www.punditnetwork.com. And I will promise you that we will have our impeachment and removal predictions up by the end of the week. And you can all weigh in on that. And when I'm back next time, I'll let you know what the audience said.
I do have a caller that sent in a question, did not want to speak on the air, but asks, what role, if any, does the Mueller report play in these current impeachment investigations?
That's actually an excellent question. I see the current investigation as, if you will, Mueller report or Russia investigation too, because the politics, as I said, of Ukraine and Russia are completely tied together. When Donald Trump started his conversation, his recorded conversation with President Zelensky, the first thing he wanted to talk about was the offshoots of the Mueller report. He wanted Zelensky to go out and find evidence that, in fact, Russia had not interfered with the 2016 election, that, in fact, it was Ukraine operatives who were eager to help the Hillary Clinton campaign. That's a conspiracy theory that pops up in the alt-right media a lot. It's been thoroughly debunked, but Donald Trump was hoping he could find some evidence to support that. So one leads right into the other. The real difference here is that this time Trump has lost a good deal of plausible deniability because it's his own voice that is the primary piece of evidence against him.
Let me turn it to Robert in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. You know, I'd like to think I have the patience of a saint, but I would love to find out what you think would be what your estimate would be on the time frame that it would take for the impeachment hearings to progress and for the president to be removed from office.
Oh, but before we get there, I think Robert really hit it right on the head, but his question skipped a couple steps. So before we get there, I think the first question is, will there be an impeachment?
It's certainly looking like it. And Robert, you asked a great question because the breaking news today is that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has actually set up a tentative schedule. He has said, and I'm surprised that he thinks that this is going to move that fast, but McConnell expects articles of impeachment to be issued by Thanksgiving, and he expects the impeachment trial to be done by Christmas. That's a rapid pace. That would be a rapid pace for an ordinary criminal trial in San Mateo or San Francisco County, but that's what he expects, and he is bringing his senators together. He did a PowerPoint presentation explaining the Senate's rules of procedure for impeachment, which, believe it or not, there actually are such things. He fielded questions like the senators wanted to know, well, can we multitask or do we have to focus on the impeachment trial all day until we get to a verdict? And the answer is, yes, they can multitask. The rules of impeachment say that the trial starts at noon, and they have to work on it all afternoon, 6 days a week, until they reach a conclusion, but they can do other things in the morning.
And with that, let me go to Howard in San Jose.
Hi there, guys.
Hey, Howard.
I'm like a typical younger American in that I have a lot of stagnant wages and insurmountable lifetime debt. So suffice it to say, I don't have a lot of faith in the institutions of our government. And I also read that a lot of countries that have set up strong presidential republics in the last century have usually gone to chaos. My question is, Dean, is seeing all this stuff that's happening with it seeming that whatever it takes to count as inappropriate to be in office, the bar rising higher and higher, do you see this country resembling those other countries around the world who have seemed to have fallen into, I don't know, corruption that cannot be withdrawn from?
You know what? That is a great question. Let me give you a kind of a long answer to that. I think I'm a little bit older than you. I've seen 11 presidents. Of those presidents, about a third have been removed from office by assassination or have resigned or have been impeached at some point. And every time something like that has happened, it's been a stress test for our institutions. And I believe that for our democracy, as the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. Every time we've gone through one of those crises, our democratic institutions have been stronger, partly because the people who were the younger generation like you at that time learned that democracy is not a given, that you have to participate in it and you have to fight for it. And I think that your generation is going to learn that lesson from this process, and we're going to emerge from this as a better and stronger democracy. And I think the lesson we're going to learn is that you can't take it for granted.
And ultimately, I think it also goes back to a comment I made earlier. I think that when these House managers go to present their case to the Senate, it's not just going to be to the Senate. It's going to be to the rest of the country. And if the evidence is not there to support an impeachment, hopefully the senators will do the right thing and not support it. And similarly, if the evidence is there, they'll hopefully do the right thing. But the bottom line is, as in any judicial process, you need everybody watching to have faith in the outcome. If it gets misreported and people not watching don't really get it, so be it. That happens. But at least those that are there should feel that everyone is heard, should feel that the right outcome occurred, should feel that there's justice, and should feel a sense of relief and a sense of faith in our democracy and in the whole system as a whole. And when we skip that, when we start going after vendettas and go off in directions and don't really try to, in essence, what most of us would think is to do the right thing, we put our whole democracy in peril.
We certainly do. And, you know, there's an interesting and kind of an odd passage in the Senate rules on impeachment. There's a requirement in those rules that during the trial of an impeachment, the doors of the Senate shall remain at all times open. And I think that's not just for cross ventilation. I think that means that the Senate is open to public view so that the public can not only know that justice was done, but they can actually see that justice was done. And they can see if the Senate does the right thing, they're going to see that. If the Senate sells out to partisan political ends, they're going to see that as well. Either way, the system was designed over 200 years ago to accommodate this kind of thing, and it's proven resilient time after time. I think it's going to prove even more resilient this time.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Here with me in the studio is Emmy-nominated, a commentator on both legal and political issues. Together, Dean Johnson and I are looking at the nuts and bolts of the congressional investigations underway, whether it leads to impeachment. What will that look like? If you have questions for my guest, and there's still a few minutes to do so, the number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. You don't have to jump in where we are in our conversation. Again, toll-free, 866-798-8255. Mark in San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I have a question, and I think it's a legal question. And basically, we're dealing with someone here, Trump, who has demonstrated again and again that he won't play by anyone's rules and that he will respect nothing. And so my question is, what if Trump, you know, basically refuses to cooperate with this process, including if it's decided to remove him, and anything that happens, if he refuses to cooperate, and for that matter, down the road, if there is an election and he loses, especially if he loses narrowly, what if he refuses to accept that? So that's the question.
Well, that was actually sort of the first question we asked when we opened the show. Where are we now? Impeachment, coup d'etat, or something else? That would amount to a coup d'etat. Donald Trump would then be sitting in the White House illegally. The trial can continue in his absence. The Senate rules specifically provide for that. So if he decides not to show up, they can go ahead with the trial. He can be acquitted or convicted. And if convicted, that becomes a question of exactly who the Senate will send to remove him from the White House. Donald or Michael Pence will, of course, take over as President of the United States at that point, but Donald Trump would have to leave. And I would imagine that the Congress might contact the U.S. Marshals Service, have them walk over and say, Mr. Trump, you know, you're going to have to come with us. But I don't think we're ever going to get to that point. The good thing, if there's a silver lining to this at all, the good thing is that so far everything has happened within the within our institutional framework. Even Trump's lawyers are making legal arguments. Some of them may be specious, they may be questionable, but they are making legal arguments to the court and to the Congress. So they are staying within the rule of law. And I have a hard time envisioning anybody saying that, no, I'm going to overturn all of the institutions of the United States and I'm going to try to hold on to power. It won't work. There are U.S. Marshals. There's the FBI. There are even soldiers who are citizen soldiers who won't let our democracy go down the tubes that easily.
And for many of our listeners, we went down that road so far as a president who did everything possible to not cooperate. Right to the point of withholding and potentially destroying evidence, the Supreme Court ruled that President Nixon had to turn over the Watergate tapes, could not get around that. And I believe it was 12 days between that ruling and him resigning from office, knowing that he was about to be impeached and that he would not make it through the Senate. The end was near. Let me turn it to Dave and Visalia. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks. And I have a question actually kind of dovetailing the call that you had before. You said, one of you said, that, you know, if this process is not, grabbed politically, then it would work. How do we know the process hasn't already been grabbed politically? I mean, all we see are screaming on both sides of this issue, and I don't really see any way that this can be anything other than political at this point. Do you disagree with that?
Well, there's always a political component, and ultimately the people who are doing this are politicians. But in the United States, we really like the idea of competition. The Democratic Party is in competition with the Republican Party, and so Democrats, who happen to hold a majority in the House of Representatives now, are pursuing? What are their own political interests? And as it happens, their own political interests coincide with what may very well be the public interest. If there is, in fact, a president who is abusing his political power, they are now systematically gathering the evidence that is the case, and we'll proceed just as we would with a trial. I mean, one could say that the judicial system or the legal system is corrupt, and there may be elements of that, but ultimately the system of advocacy, of trials, of cross-examination of evidence works, and we get what we think are generally fair results.
Dave, one thing that I will add to what Dean just said, our entire system of justice, and this is a little different system that when we're talking impeachment, there's a lot of politics, but that dialectic between two sides taking very opposite positions and fighting with one another, occasionally getting together and reason it out, but really taking opposite positions and trying to explore them, is so built into our system of justice. Most criminal cases, one person versus the accuser, the government, and where does it go? When you have civil trials, it's very seldom anything other than one side against one other side. It's like that throughout our whole legal system. It's typically like that in elections. Once it whittles down, you have overwhelmingly one person versus another. And the idea is that you let everything air out from the extreme positions they take, from the lack of sharing ideas, but rather exploring ideas in which they differ. And the idea is that the best outcome usually prevails. I can't speak to the political system. That's not what I do, but I work within the legal system for many, many years now, as does Dean. And from my perspective, it's a very flawed system. Every other system I've seen is far, far worse. It's the best we have, and it overwhelmingly gets it right most of the time, even if it's not a pleasant experience. Do you feel the same way, Dean?
Well, I do, and there's a little historical tidbit that I always tell my students. The founders of our republic believed more than anything in what we call adversarial systems. They believe that competition brought out the best in people, and the people pursuing their own self-interest, whether it be in the free market or in politics or in the court, and competing with one another on a level playing field, ultimately brought out the very best and led to just and fair outcomes. And there was a book that came out in 1776, when the founders were thinking about forming their own republic, called The Wealth of Nations, and it said just that, and it described the invisible hand that seems to steer people who are in a competition to a point where they ultimately achieve the best outcome for all concerned. And we've incorporated that into our institutions. That adversarial system seems to work very well. As Winston Churchill once said, it's the worst system you can imagine, except for all the rest.
You know, we've gotten a pretty good chunk of the way through the outline, but we've talked about much smaller ideas than the few that are left, and what few that are left are going to be quite a bit bigger. So before we go much further, Dean, let me ask you straight up, would you like to continue this conversation next week?
Oh, I'd love to. I mean, we've just scratched the surface here. This is an enormously important time for our republic. It's a time when our institutions are being stress tested, and the more we can do to promote this dialogue and to make people think about the issues, the better our republic is. That's one of the reasons I started Pundit Network. That's one of the reasons I love coming on here and talking to your listeners. I'd be happy to come back.
So we will continue this program next week, and we have much loftier, bigger questions. Whether there's going to be an impeachment, what evidence might be required, what does a president have to do to warrant impeachment, much less removal from office? What's the evidence that's surfaced so far? Is there more out there? What does the public want? What are they saying today? Where's that going to change? And ultimately, the bottom line, is there evidence enough? And who decides it? And what role do we all play, if any at all? These are the questions we're going to be looking at next week. In a moment, I'm going to give you a couple minutes to, for any closing thoughts or summary you have, which is kind of hard to do when we're only finishing part one. But one of our callers just a couple moments ago brought up the second whistleblower and how that seems to have dropped from the headlines. And I'm wondering if you've heard anything about that. It seems that the headlines are starting to move away a little bit and not focus as much, but it seems that the House has been very busy, and only one of the committees that are carrying on these investigations has been getting a lot of play in the press, and yet there are several that are underway at the same time. Do you think the second whistleblower has gotten any airplay?
Yeah, we've all heard about the first whistleblower, the second whistleblower. Whistleblower number one apparently was relying on hearsay. He or she had not personally witnessed any of the issues with Ukraine and this, the withholding of funds and so on. According to reports, whistleblower number two had firsthand knowledge and so fully corroborated whistleblower number one. I think, as the head of the Judiciary Committee said, it probably is not even necessary to call whistleblower number one or whistleblower number two, because it doesn't matter how we learned about this. The fact is that we did learn about it. And the relevant witnesses are the people who have personal knowledge, and they're people of enormous credibility, like Masha Vojanovich, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, who is a career public servant, who was willing to take on all of those tough assignments, and who was fired for no good reason, who was told by her boss, "The president has lost confidence in you, but you haven't done anything wrong, but I have to take you away from your post." Those are the kind of people who will be testifying or whose testimony will be heard in some other means. Those are very credible witnesses. I think it's a positive thing that actually, that even though I'm a strong advocate for transparency in government, I think in this case it's a positive thing that they're allowed to testify behind closed doors so that they can testify honestly and openly without fear of reprisal. All of that is fodder for a discussion about what this impeachment process is going to look like, and you know what's going to happen in the future.
And I'd like to give you about a minute for any closing thoughts you have.
Yeah, I think this is a time when shows like this, when dialogue between people who have specific knowledge about this area and people who are just part of the general public is so important, because the more informed you are, the stronger our institutions are, and our institutions are now undergoing a stress test, and they need your support. They need your understanding. So I'm happy to come back, and we're going to deal with those loftier issues next week, and I hope everybody who's listening tunes in. Also, please sign up for Pundit Network. I'll have the impeachment question up in a day or so.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're in the midst of a discussion, as we're in the midst of an impeachment or a coup d'etat or maybe something else. What are we to make of all these investigations? With me in the studio tonight, Emmy-nominated commentator, legal and political commentator, and attorney Dean Johnson, the founder of Pundit Networks. Dean, thank you for joining us tonight.
Hey, my pleasure as always, Jeff.
As you just heard a couple moments ago, we didn't finish the material, so next week we return with part two. And in 2 weeks, we're back with our Call a Lawyer night. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Our thanks to you for listening, and for production assistant Martin McLean, and at the controls for the vacationing Joanne Marr, my friend Debbie Kennedy. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.
It's Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.